Hey everybody, if you want to tell the world something or sell the world something, head on over to Squarespace because they're going to help you build the website of your dreams. Say you want to sell some custom merch. Well, you can set up your online store. Whether you sell physical, digital, or service products, Squarespace has the tools you need to start selling online. So go to squarespace.com/stuff right now and you will face a free trial. And when you get ready to launch, use our offer code STUFF and then you'll save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. How could you go wrong with Squarespace?
Life in our modern age comes at you pretty fast, which makes our time away especially valuable. When I take time to relax, I like to get far from my everyday life, immerse myself in natural beauty, and have unique experiences. But you don't have to leave the U.S. to experience tropical rainforests and islands filled with adventure, warm culture, and national treasures. Visit Puerto Rico, an island with a vibrant spirit that will sweep you away. Because when you visit, you don't become part of the island, it becomes part of you. In Puerto Rico, you can forget where you came from and embrace where you are. Puerto Rico, where visits end, but stories last forever. No passport required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark, and there's Charles W. Chuck Bryant. The W stands for Wayne.
Mm-hmm.
Dwayne Coyne. That gets you every time.
I know. It's funny to be 45 years old and named after Wayne Coyne. Because he's
like 48, right?
No, he's 50? In his 50s.
52.
But it would be weird. I would have been named after a very, kindergarten age Wayne Coyne.
Right.
You know.
Maybe your parents were friends with his parents And they really thought a lot about him.
Boy, he's a real achiever.
Right. That Wayne Coyne's going places. Okay.
That was a weird sidetrack.
It was already out of the gate, man.
Mm-hmm.
How are you feeling?
I'm good.
Got a lot on your plate, got a lot going on.
Meh. Oh, you know what today is?
What?
Dude, today is the day that I leave this office and I go to a shop in Inman Park and pick up 4 brand new Last Chance Garage hats.
Oh, wow. It's a big day.
Very big day.
Big day.
So I have a couple of people I'd like to thank.
Uh-huh.
It's a bigger deal than it should be for a grown man in a hat, but we all understand. First of all, Katie, my custom patch maker.
Mm-hmm.
This is really where it all came together. If the patch isn't right, the hat's not right.
Right.
Katie killed it. It looks identical. And you can find her work at tulipcake.com.
Nice.
T-U-L-I-P cake.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, people might ask you, to make them Last Chance Garage patches.
Did you ever destroy the mold?
And I said, it's on you. It's up to you legally.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying you might get requests.
You should have been like Ivan the Terrible, who blinded his architects after they built his palace.
No, I don't care. People, I'd love to see these things around. And Lamood Big Hats, L-A-M-O-O-D, mm-hmm. For big heads. Because part of the problem was finding
and tall hat.
Yeah, man. Like the problem I have with hats these days, I don't look like I have a huge head,
no.
But they just fit so snugly and they don't go far down enough on my head.
Mm-hmm.
So I finally looked up oversized hats and found Lamood hats. And, dude, they're exactly like the old hat.
Nice.
Except it doesn't stink.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
Like, these are great. I got 4 brand
new. That's an improvement for sure. So are you going to put one in, like, the seed vault in Norway?
Probably one there. There will be one in the nuclear suitcase.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll wear the other 2.
At the same time.
At the same
time. Front and back like Sherlock Holmes.
That's right. Anyway, I'm super excited. So
that's pretty cool.
Thank you to Katie and Lamood Hats for allowing me to spend too much money getting 4 hats remade.
And speaking of, while we're thanking people, we owe a long overdue thank you to a guy who made us a really cool sign.
Oh, you mean the sign this guy made for us like 7 years ago?
Yeah, his name's Matt Street. He's at fatbison.com, and he made a really cool wood-carved sign.
Yeah, it was in our TV show.
It was. Like the production company got clearance rights for it and all this stuff, and we love the sign, but we just forgot to ever thank Matt. So, Matt, thank you so much for the sign. We love it. We have it hanging here in the studio. It is a work of art, and we appreciate it, and we're sorry for the oversight.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is that all the thank yous?
I think so. Let's talk about the misery index, huh?
Yeah. What a great transition.
Have you Had you heard of it before you came across this article?
Yeah, I didn't know a lot about it, though. And
apparently it's gone a little bit out of fashion lately, from what I understand.
Yeah, I think so. Because, well, let's get into it.
Okay. It turns out economics as a whole is in danger of going out of fashion. I read this really interesting article on Aon, which is maybe the greatest website on the planet. Okay. Aon dot, it might be dot co, because I think
it's
British.
About a lot of websites.
I think I say it about Aon a lot.
Okay.
And it just seems like I'm talking about different ones. But there's this article by Alan J. Levinovitz, and it's called The New Astrology.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically makes a parallel between economics and economists and economic theory when you take economics and try to apply it to future forecasting.
Right.
And the BCE Chinese astrologers that basically directed the way that the economy or the government was going to move based on the movements of the stars.
So what are they saying? It's, you might as well just do that?
He draws some pretty interesting parallels between the two, that economics in and of itself is not necessarily flawed, but when it's used to forecast the future, then it becomes inherently flawed.
Yeah.
And this article really kind of
that.
Little bit. Yeah, to an extent. I mean, the misery index is a legitimate economic tool, and it's hit or miss in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think one thing that hit home to me with researching this is it just seems impossible to say that there's one correct way of doing things.
Right, or
that is absolute. And you're like, you know, if you do things this way, then there will be nothing but growth in jobs and the GDP and GNP. And it just doesn't seem to work that way.
Right. I think the problem is that if you listen to economists, they like to act like they do have a handle on that kind of thing. But if you really look into economics, it's very politicized. There's liberal economics and there's conservative economics. And the fact that each one's saying it's right kind of makes you think that maybe no one is, you know? But the misery index actually started out from a guy who was pretty good at walking the line between conservative and liberal economics. A guy, what was his name? Okun.
Yeah, Arthur Okun.
Right.
And he worked on Kennedy's staff, his Council of Economic Advisors, John F. Kennedy, that mm-hmm. is. And he was, I get the feeling, one of the main influences in talking Kennedy, who initially did not necessarily agree, but talking Kennedy into kind of trying to enact both conservative and liberal economic policies simultaneously.
Right. The U.S. was in a recession when Kennedy took office in 1961. And they talked him into not only increasing government spending, like welfare programs, they raised the minimum wage and some other stuff like that. But they also cut taxes, you do one or the other. You cut taxes and hope everything goes for the best because businesses will start investing in spending, or you start investing in welfare programs to help your ailing lower and middle classes, right? You don't do both.
Yeah.
And Kennedy did both, and it was successful.
Yeah. At first he said,
I don't know about this.
I don't know about this, Arthur.
Mike Kennedy sounds like a robot.
Mine kind of did too, actually.
Yours is fine.
But Arthur, Mr. Okun. Okun? Okun.
I think Okun.
Okun. It's a weird name. O-K-U-N. Mm-hmm. He talked him into it and said, trust me. And things worked out. In that case.
Yeah, well, and a lot of guys, including Okun's names, were made by this advice that panned out. Like, the U.S. entered a boom.
Yeah.
And Okun ended up as being the head of the Council of Economic Advisors for Kennedy's successor, Lyndon Johnson, right?
Yeah, and one thing that economists mm-hmm. love to do mm-hmm. is, they love to forecast and all that stuff, but it's all about data.
Sure.
And man, they love to pour over data.
Yeah.
Like stuff that makes the average person, their mind bleed from boredom. They just find it fascinating.
That's what they do on Friday nights.
Friday nights. They pour over data, historical data, trying to find, you know, it's like the big puzzle and they're all trying to solve it.
Right.
So they pour over this data, Okun did, and he said, you know what? I noticed something here. Between 1948, when we started recording some decent unemployment rates.
Right.
which I didn't know. I didn't know he started that in 1948.
Yeah, it seems like it would have gone back before then.
But between 1948 and 1960, he said, you know what? I've noticed that the gross national product rises 3% for every percentage point that unemployment falls, with the caveat that unemployment has to be between 3 and 7.5%.
Right.
Which is a pretty, like, it's a pretty bold statement to say, I've noticed this is a definite trend.
It is. And it came to be called Okun's Law because it was verified. Other people poured over the data and are like, this guy's right. Man, he just keeps coming up with hits, doesn't he?
That's right.
And the reason you would want to know some arcane piece of data like that is that if you know that that's the case, then you can say, well, if we attack unemployment, can get it down a couple of points, we can, you know, raise GDP or GNP, you know, by 3% every time we drop it. So when we need to bulk GNP up,
yeah,
we just attack unemployment, right?
Right.
Easy peasy.
Yeah.
And everyone said, thank you, Art.
Yeah, things worked out pretty well for a while, but then the 1970s came along. And we're going to talk a little bit about stagflation now, but if you haven't heard it, we have a pretty good episode.
Was it good?
I think so.
Okay.
It's called What is Stagflation from February 24, 2011. Uh-huh. I think as far as our economics episodes, it was not bad.
Okay.
I went back and listened to a lot of it.
Oh, okay, good.
Before I got bored.
So it checks out?
Yeah, the first 3 minutes were great.
Sweet.
But yeah, go back and listen to that. But like he said, he served as chairman of the CEA for Johnson. And then in 1973, a very unfortunate thing happened that kind of ended up rocking the world and the United States in particular, right, with our economy. So we're going to take a break, and we're going to talk when we get back about the Middle East.
Hey there, are you thirsty? Well, before you take a sip, have you stopped to think about what's in your water? Many conventional bottled waters contain PFAS, harmful substances known as forever chemicals. But you can drink water as clean as nature intended.
Richard's Rainwater collects 100% pure, refreshing drops of rain. Yes, it really is rain, everybody. This rain is caught clean before it hits the ground or becomes polluted with pesticides and contaminants commonly found in groundwater.
Yep, Richard's Rainwater is naturally pure with no need for harsh chemicals or additives. That means no added fluoride, no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing.
And you can enjoy the clean taste of Richard's still rainwater and the long-lasting cold-pressured bubbles of Richard's sparkling rainwater. Just visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. That's richardsrainwater.com. And we even have a special offer, don't we, Josh?
Yeah, text STUFF to 2512928887, and you'll get $2 off a 12-pack case of Richard's Rainwater. Sip the sky. Hey, everybody, we're here to tell you about Viator, a tool that you can use to plan and book travel experiences around the world.
That's right. The Viator app and website make it easy to explore 300,000 plus travel experiences so you can discover what's out there no matter where you're traveling or what you're interested in.
Yep, Viator can help you plan better travel experiences. 300,000 plus travel experiences to choose from means you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy.
That's right. You can also enjoy real traveler reviews to get insider information from people who've already been on the experience that you're considering. Plus, you get free cancellation that helps you plan for the unexpected.
Yeah, and Viator offers 24/7 customer service, so you know you'll get support at any hour if things aren't going as planned. So download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find the perfect travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
All right, what happened in 1973?
The
I'm 2 years old.
I am negative three.
Okay.
The Arab oil embargo happened, right?
That's right.
So at the time, until very recently, the U.S. was super dependent on foreign oil.
Yeah.
Like other countries we wouldn't even sit down at the table with, we were getting oil from, right?
Yeah, we're doing better now.
Yeah.
With our dependency. But back then, very bad.
Very. And it was a source of anxiety for a lot of people, and that anxiety actually panned out. So in 1973, Egypt and Syria and a few other Arab nations invaded the Golan Heights and the Sinai Peninsula to attempt to take back land from the state of Israel, right?
That's right.
The U.S. Was found to be supplying arms to Israel. So as far as the Arab states were concerned, the U.S. had cast its lot on Israel's side.
Yeah.
And they were fairly peeved about that. So they literally shut off the tap of oil flowing to the United States and to other countries that were found considered to be on the side of Israel in this war.
Huge deal.
It was an enormous deal. This foreign dependency and the precarious situation that it placed the United States in came to pass. And the price of oil rose 37%. The long lines at the gas station were never seen before or since, even after the financial crisis of 2008.
Yeah.
It was just insane. There was gas rationing in the United States in 1973 because of the oil embargo. And after a while, the taps were turned back on. But that shock to the system screwed the economy up for a decade.
Yeah. Inflation went out of control. And another unfortunate thing happened. Along the same timeline, unemployment started to creep up. And these two things happening at the same time is devastating.
Yeah, and up to this point, so first of all, the U.S. had never had a shock to the system like that. That was one thing.
Yeah, it wasn't a gradual thing.
It was abrupt.
Yeah.
But the other thing is when you have something that has never happened before, you can look at it and say, wow, what happened? And new things that have never happened before come out of that. And one of the things was inflation and unemployment going up. Because up to this point, economists just assumed that the two were mutually exclusive.
Sure.
Like if inflation was up, prices were high, that meant that companies could go out and hire more people.
Yeah.
So unemployment, of course, would be low.
Yeah, it kind of made sense.
Well, not after the oil embargo.
Yeah.
The shock to the system led to, like you said, high unemployment rates and high inflation. And it was a miserable time.
Yeah, and that was called stagflation.
Mm-hmm.
It also led to skateboarding, as we all know.
Oh, yeah, because of the pools, right?
Yeah, they could in California. Well, actually, that was the drought. But I think the drought was also tied into the economics.
Sure.
But they couldn't fill up swimming pools, so they started skating in swimming pools.
Well, yeah, if you have a drought, then you lose your crops. And if you lose your crops, you lose money, a significant sector of money.
Exactly. So good news, we have half pipes now.
Right.
And quarter pipes.
And Powell Peralta.
And Peralta. They're still around, right?
I think so,
Of course. Bad news is, like you said, it had a devastating effect for many, many years on the United States.
Right.
So Okun starts to look around. He said, you know what? Things are pretty bad here. One might even say miserable.
I haven't gotten any acclaim for a while.
Yeah. Nothing's been named after me in a while.
Right.
So let me create this new method for looking at the economy. And it turns out to not be like a look over a period of time or anything, but just sort of like a Polaroid of that day.
And not just that day for like the country as a whole or for the Fed or anything like that. But what he did that was different was he looked into what it was like that day or that year for the average American.
Yes.
In their daily life.
Right.
And he called it the misery index.
Yeah. And it was very rudimentary. At the time, it was just a simple calculation of the yearly rate of inflation plus the unemployment rate.
Yeah. So if you have like 5% inflation and 2% unemployment, you have a 7% misery index. It's as simple as that.
I don't know why it got so much, you know, why it was hailed as a big deal.
Because I think Okun had a knack for noticing things that seemed obvious in retrospect.
Right.
But at the time, no one had ever noticed before.
Okay. I'll buy it.
Thank you.
Why not? All right, so now he has this index, and not only can he look at a snapshot of that day, he can go back because he was a data wonk,
sure.
And he could look at data throughout history.
Well, at least to 1948.
Yeah, which is when we started recording unemployment, like we said.
Which must have been frustrating for him because our inflation rates data goes back to 1914, but that's only part of the equation. Well, so he must have been like, oh, man.
Sure. And to be able to look at the Great Depression, you could have learned a lot, you know?
Sure.
So he went and he looked back and he says, here is what we've noticed. And this is so obvious to me, that presidents and political parties are brought in and out of office largely depending on how the economy is doing.
Yeah.
But they kind of proved it.
But not even just how the economy is doing. Like he was saying, like the misery index, you can use it to predict whether, the presidency is going to change hands politically.
Yeah. So 1956, misery index is 6.53, which is great.
That's during Ike.
Yeah, very low. Mr. Eisenhower, President Eisenhower. And he got reelected because things were pretty good.
Right.
As far as the misery index goes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody was pretty happy. Even though they didn't really know what the misery index was because it wasn't invented yet.
Right.
They just had a general sense.
Well, yeah, they didn't call it that at the time.
No, they're just like, seems fine to me.
You miserable?
We like Ike. Nope. No, I'm not miserable. Are you?
So in 1968, Johnson came to the end of his term, and the misery index was up to 8.13, and then he had his Democratic successor, Hubert Humphrey, in line. And because the thing had crept up, people were a little more miserable, and they says, no, get out of here. I want Mr. Nixon in office.
Right. And I guess I'm not sure about this. So I don't understand why Johnson was replaced by Humphrey, by the Democrats. And this article, and it seems to be because of this misery index that it would have predicted that. But he was the incumbent president.
Oh, is
and
he
his own
only
party.
A one-termer?
Let's see. So he would have.
I should know this.
No, he was a one-termer. Technically one in a third or one in a quarter because he took over after Kennedy's assassination. But if his term was up in 68, then he would have won the 64 election. So he technically, I think, would have been able to have been president again. I'm not sure.
We could have found this out, too.
Sure, but I'll bet there's somebody out there who can explain it to us. And
sure.
If so, email us, will you?
At any rate, Nixon gets elected, and the misery index shot up to 11.67 during the first term, but then started to decline enough that he did get reelected. But then, in 1974 with Watergate, the misery index leapt all the way up to 17.01.
That's not good.
No.
That was the all-time high at the time, from what I understand.
I think so.
And that happened around 1974, which meant that when Watergate broke, some people who really subscribe to the misery index say Watergate might not have been quite as big a deal if the misery index had been low at the time.
Right.
He might have been able to squeak by without resigning or being forced out of office.
I think everyone has more leeway if things are great.
Sure.
You know?
But his currency had been spent.
Man, I watched All the President's Men a few weeks ago again.
Yeah.
You ever seen that?
No.
Great, great movie.
Yeah. I've always meant to.
Really, really good. And just sort of like, they don't make a lot of movies like that anymore. Spotlight reminded me of All the President's Men.
Sure. I haven't seen that one yet either.
It's good. It's just, I call it movies for adults, you know. There's no chase scenes or anything remarkable. It's just good, dramatic movie making.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Anyway.
Wait, what's wrong with chase scenes?
Huh?
What's wrong with chase scenes?
No, there's nothing inherently wrong with a chase scene. But
I know what you mean.
Just for the sake of a chase scene, which we see a lot of these days. You know what I mean?
Like Mark Ruffalo's chasing a priest in a car in Spotlight.
Yeah. Where were we? Okay, we were with Nixon. Well, not with Nixon. You know what I mean. Ford comes in office for a short time.
And he actually managed to get the misery index down.
Well, I think just the fact that Nixon was out, I think that probably helped.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And inspire, like, consumer confidence and the like. So it crept back down to 12.66, but not enough to keep the Democrats and Jimmy Carter from coming into office.
And Carter actually cited the misery index.
Yeah.
It was relatively new at the time.
Yeah. He talked too much about it.
But it was a gee whiz thing that you could really just point to, like, this plus this, this is the misery index.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
That's my quote.
But,
that was his famous quote. Can you hear me?
It came back to haunt him though, to say the least, because he talked a lot about the misery index. And then in his, term, the, it reached an all-time high of 21.98.
Yeah, which, man, I really think that shock to the system under the oil embargo and plenty of other stuff. This stuff gets laid at Carter's feet, I think, unfairly in a lot of respects.
Well, I mean, I would love for someone to really, that really knows their stuff to explain to me exactly how much a president's influence has on the economy and how long it takes for that to bear fruit.
Yeah, I would love to know that too. I think though, the guy who came after Carter, Reagan, is a pretty sterling, unassailable example of an impact a president can have on the economy. Whether you agree with his politics or his
right.
economic policies or not, he most decidedly had an effect on the economy.
Yeah, I just remember hearing one time, I need to look this up, but somebody told me once that the economic impact of a presidential, a four-year term, mm-hmm. is felt the most like 8 years later or something.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Economies don't move on a dime.
Yeah, I don't know if that's correct.
They're big, hulking, lumbering things that aren't fully understood by anybody.
Yeah, it's interesting to me now more than ever before, though. Because remember, economics used to just bore me to tears.
I know. I was really, really surprised when you suggested this one.
It's slightly more interesting to me now.
What changed?
Oh, just wondering things like that and during an election season.
Yeah.
Like, are the decisions we make now going to affect us in 1 year, 2 years, 8 years?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, if there's any economists who are still listening after that initial remark about the new astrology... We'd love to get a primer on how long it takes for a president to impact an economy, if they do at all.
And I'm sure it's a range, you know.
Sure.
It's not like starting at 8 years.
And really, honestly, was Carter that bad, or was he a victim of cross stars?
Yeah. I mean, you can make a case for a lot of ills of presidencies not being directly at their feet.
Well, you remember that that Simpsons where they unveil a statue of Jimmy Carter in Springfield, and on the pedestal it says "Malaise forever," and somebody goes, "Jimmy Carter, he's history's greatest monster." Poor Carter.
So, like we said, it came back to haunt Carter because he talked a lot about the index. It rose a lot. Then Reagan came in and was like, "Well, let's talk about that misery index that you like to talk about so much.
Right.
That's at an all-time high." Reagan got in there, knocked it down to 9.55 by the end of his term, enough to get Bush Sr. in. It inched up some, then Clinton was able to – it didn't go up that much, though. And I read an interesting article today on whether or not Ross Perot really got Clinton elected, because that's sort of the popular thought.
He was a spoiler?
Yeah.
I could see that.
But
he was definitely more in line with Bush Sr.'s policies than Clinton's.
Well,
or at the time.
Yeah, you would think, but I read one article that said that it was kind of a myth that basically that Clinton won by 6 million votes and it would have taken 75% of Perot supporters to have been aligned with Bush.
Mm.
And supposedly exit polls showed it more like 38-40%.
Mm.
And so they're saying it's sort of a myth that Perot swung the election to Clinton.
I see.
But, I mean, that was one person's opinion, so who knows?
You know, I've been reading a lot about, you know, that suspicion you can't quite kick, that there's really no difference between Republicans and Democrats these days, that they're really just kind of all in the same little club?
I think people feel that way sometimes.
I've been reading a lot about that, and apparently it's all based on neoliberalism. That's like the key.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a lot of, if you look into neoliberalism and the policies of neoliberalism, you realize we're like living in the thick of it, but everyone's kind of blind to the idea that it's just a single thing that basically everybody in power subscribes to.
Right.
And that it has a trickle down effect of screwing over everybody below the top.
Yeah.
But just the name itself seems totally fine, you know, but it's interesting.
Yeah, well, I researched that a little bit lately, too.
Yeah, there's been some good articles. We totally should.
Yeah.
Let's do it, Chuck.
Agreed.
Man, we're going to get some emails for that one from billionaires.
Yeah. So let's just finish out this quick little recap. Clinton brought it down to 7.35. Things were great. Bush Jr. gets elected, despite the fact that Clinton had a low index.
Well, it depends on how you look at the 2000 election.
Well, we should do one on that one too.
But that's considered one of those rare instances where the
right.
misery index didn't indicate where it was going to go. But
right.
you could also say, it might have.
Sure.
Had things gone slightly differently in the Supreme Court.
George W. Bush, the index rose from 7.35 to 11.4. And then Obama came in, it went down to 7.87. But another weird flaw in the system is exposed there because despite the fact that the misery index was lower, things were not good. The stock market had crashed. Unemployment was rising at a rapid rate. And they said, you know, this, it basically was another example of like, look, this misery index isn't all it's cracked up to be.
Right.
So let's work on it.
Yeah. I think a lot of people said this is too simplistic. You can't rely on this.
Yeah.
But we'll talk about some of the additional factors that people have worked into the misery index after this. Hey there, are you thirsty? Well, before you take a sip, have you stopped to think about what's in your water? Many conventional bottled waters contain PFAS, harmful substances known as forever chemicals. But you can drink water as clean as nature intended.
Richard's Rainwater collects 100% pure, refreshing drops of rain. Yes, it really is rain, everybody. This rain is caught clean before it hits the ground or becomes polluted with pesticides and contaminants commonly found in groundwater.
Yep, Richard's rainwater is naturally pure with no need for harsh chemicals or additives. That means no added fluoride, no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing.
And you can enjoy the clean taste of Richard's still rainwater and the long-lasting cold-pressured bubbles of Richard's sparkling rainwater. Just visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. That's richardsrainwater.com. And we even have a special offer, don't we, Josh?
Yeah, text STUFF to 2512928887, and you'll get $2 off a 12-pack case of Richard's rainwater. Sip the sky.
Hey, friends. As every parent knows, kids seem to be everywhere all at once, and it's really tough for even the most watchful moms and dads to protect their little ones from every single thing.
Yeah, Duracell understands this, and that's why they're deeply committed to lithium coin battery safety. Lithium coin batteries power a bunch of important things around people's homes, including things young children may have access to. So Duracell not only educates parents, caregivers, and medical professionals about the importance of lithium coin battery safety, they also make the only lithium coin batteries with a non-toxic bitter coating to help discourage children from swallowing them.
Even Duracell's packaging is child secure and designed to avoid accidental opening. Because they believe their products should provide more than just power. They should also provide peace of mind. You can learn more at Duracell.com/power safely. Available on 2032, 2025, and 2016 sizes.
All right, Chuck. So the misery index, Oaken, everybody's happy with him.
Yeah.
But they're like, this is just too simple, especially in what's called the post-stagflation era after the oil embargo.
Yeah.
And so some people have said, okay, you can, there's other things you can add in to give a genuine, true snapshot of what the conditions are like on the ground, as it were, right?
Well, yeah, not only what the conditions are, but whether or not performance over a period of time is getting better or getting worse.
Yes. And, you know, rather than say, oh, under this president, the misery index was this, you know, and it gives you a pretty good idea.
Yeah.
This one guy named Robert Barrow, he wrote a 1996 book called Getting It Right, Markets and Choices in a Free Society. And in it, he takes the misery index, Oaken's misery index, and he says, we can add some stuff to this to make it an even clearer picture,
yeah,
not just of the conditions on the ground, but you can take it and apply it genuinely to a president's entire term to see just how good their economic policies were or weren't for the health of the economy.
Yeah.
And he added some other stuff.
Yeah, right? He added four main new measurements. Took the inflation rate during the last year of the president's term, compared it to the average inflation rate over the entire course of the subsequent president's term.
Which is based on what you were saying, that like the a 4-year term,
right,
the effects are felt like years down the road.
Sure.
So I think that's what he was doing there, right?
Yeah, it makes sense. Did the same thing with the rate of unemployment. That was number two. He added in changes for the 30-year government bond yield over a presidency. And then finally, he said, I need to look at the difference between the long-term GDP growth, the real rate of growth.
Right.
Compare all these things along with the original this plus this equals this.
Right. And with the real growth rate, that's where you take the actual change, either the shrinking or the growth of the economy, the GDP year over year, right?
Yes.
And he took that for year after year over the course of a presidency and averaged it out, I guess.
That's right.
Yeah, and he came up with what's called the Barrow Misery Index. And a lot of people think that that's where the Misery Index started, when in fact it was Okun who came up with it about 20 years before Barrow took it up and improved it.
Yeah. So under Barrow's Misery Index, Clinton and Reagan, that's Bill Clinton, of course, came out on top.
Mm-hmm.
And then a guy named Steve Hanke, about 10 years later, this was originally in 1996, and then Hanke came along in 2006. And said, you know what, we need to add even more things. And this all just makes sense. You need to, if you want a more detailed picture, then add more detail to the data going in, you know?
Right.
So he said, we need more detail. Why don't we do this? Let's measure inflation and unemployment like we're doing. And then let's now add interest rates and subtract annual percentages from the GDP to get a more accurate picture.
Right.
And he said, you can use this anywhere. You can use it all over the world.
Well, that's what he did. And that's kind of what made his version of it pretty famous. He figured out how to apply it to other countries, even countries that used, price controls to keep inflation in check, which means inflation is held back artificially. So Hanke looked into other things like, the exchange rate in the black market in a given country, that kind of thing. And he figured out real inflation rates, and he applied it around the world to find out what country is the most miserable and what country is the least miserable. And what he found in 2014 was that the most miserable country in the world was Venezuela.
Yeah.
Which had a Hanke misery index, of 79.4. It's pretty high.
Very high.
And then Japan had the lowest misery at 5.41.
Yeah, the U.S. came in at about 19, correct?
I think 11.
Oh, 11th?
Yeah.
No, 11 was our...
Oh, I'm sorry, 19th. Yeah.
You're right. Ranked 19th.
Yes.
With an 11 rating.
I didn't hear the...
Yeah, that's because my tooth is still gone. You'd think it'd be more pronounced, the THs.
If they were 19th... I would have heard it clear as a bell.
August. Can't get here soon enough. So there are critics of this one, too, though. There's critics of all these indexes.
Well, yeah. A lot of them say, no, still too elementary.
Yeah.
Some people say this is all just tripe. Like, you can't.
Sure.
You can't use this stuff to make any real predictions. You could use it to look back at the past, but to use it for the future, probably not. But some people do believe in the idea that if you have enough data and the right kind of data, you can get a clear picture of misery. And again, that's what we're after here. Like, the whole point of the misery index is to figure out how unhappy and just low the average person in a country is feeling at that moment.
Yeah.
Right? So HuffPo actually came up with a pretty good one. HuffPo.
Boo! Yay!
In 2009, HuffPo came up with what they called the Real Misery Index, right? And so a lot of people cite the use of what's called U3 unemployment statistics.
Yeah.
Which, when you hear unemployment numbers in the news, that's what you're hearing. That's what the Bureau of Labor Statistics issues as the official unemployment numbers, right?
Yeah, and that's the very first thing that people will say if they want to poo-poo the unemployment numbers.
That these are just false numbers.
Yeah, if someone says, hey, man, look how great ex-president is doing. Look at the unemployment rate.
Right.
They say, man, they're just using the U3.
Right.
They need to use the U6.
Wake up, pal.
Yeah.
Open your eyes.
Which, you know, is valid.
Well, yeah, so the BLS has six measurements of unemployment, U1 through U6. And U6 is the broadest.
Yeah.
It includes people who are so discouraged with the state of the job market that they've given up looking for work,
mm-hmm.
and are just like, have given themselves over entirely to Judge Alex.
Sure.
Right? And then it also includes people who are working part-time but wish they could work full-time, but there's no full-time work available.
Yeah, like, so, I'm a graphic designer, but I work at Starbucks.
So that's the U6 measurement, and that's considered the broadest snapshot of unemployment, the real vision of unemployment.
Yeah, like you said, mostly they use U3, I guess, because it's in the middle. I mean, U1 they would never use. U2,
Everybody used to like, but not anymore.
I still like you too.
Do you? Good.
Yeah, you know, not like I used to.
I'm not poo-pooing anything.
But I did see that concert they did on HBO.
Uh-huh.
And I have to hand it to them. My big problem with U2 for years was they just got so out of control with those live shows.
Mm.
Like these giant spider spaceships and things. And
right.
I was always of the belief that, man, you need to go back to basics and just get up on stage and play again.
Yeah.
And that's what they did with this new tour. I mean, there was a cool visual element, but the stage setup and the way they did it was very much back to basics in
it. Oh, that's cool.
I think they really connected with fans again.
Yeah, that's got to help.
Yeah.
Because
you can only,
I mean, when the interactions between you and the fans rather than the fans and giant spiders.
Yeah, you can only go so far in that direction. I think they realize that.
Sure.
Anyway.
Way to go, you two.
I'll defend those guys. Even though I know everyone in the world generally wants to punch Bono in the face.
I know.
I'm not one of them.
It's got to feel weird.
I like him.
Yeah.
I'm on record.
Sure.
Bono, if you're listening.
Well, if your Jared indicator is any predictor, Bono's going to come out to be canonized one day.
If what? Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know? You're like, there's something about Jared. I don't like him. And, you know, we found out about Jared.
Right.
And then so now like, you're saying,
Bono's,
I like Bono.
Good guy.
Something's going to, like, they're going to find a cure for cancer in his saliva or something.
You never know. So did we even mention what the HuffPo, what kind of outrageous numbers they came up with?
No, well, we didn't mention everything they used. We were talking about the U6 measurement. HuffPo used that measurement.
The most extreme one.
Of unemployment numbers. They also used other things like the inflation rate of food and drink and fuel and healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
Because the misery index just uses the consumer price index, which is inflation as a whole.
Right.
HuffPo used the inflation of some really essential things that people can't do without.
Yeah.
And where you're going to immediately feel the pinch when prices go up with those
key
things,
factors.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
They also included the rate of credit card delinquency, the cost of housing, how many people are using food stamps.
Yeah.
That seems like a smart move.
Totally.
Home equity loan deficiencies.
Uh-huh.
I guess people who are late on their payments. And then they took the average of those seven numbers and added it to the U6 unemployment numbers, which, here you can step back and say, wait a minute, how are you adding this together? How does this make any sense?
You can't just keep adding things.
Right. And really, you can take that all the way back to the initial misery index. Like, what? You're just adding unemployment percentage and inflation, and all of a sudden you have a magic number that doesn't make any sense. This HuffPo metric really points out the inherent flaw in it, I think.
Yeah, because in 2008, the Okun misery index was 8.1, but HuffPo's real misery index, AKA, you think things are bad, here's how bad they really are index, was 29.9 compared to the 8.1.
Right. And some people are like, oh, well, that just shows how off the Okun misery index is.
Yeah. Who knows? I know they quit doing the real misery index at HuffPo like 5 years ago. I think it was a stunt? It was a bit of a stunt.
Maybe. But I'm sure really what happened was the writer who was contributing it for free.
Sure.
Like left for a paying job.
That's probably
what happened to the HuffPo Real Misery Index.
Yeah, you're probably right.
I was reading this guy, Tim McMahon. He has a site, or he writes for a site, I'm not sure if it's his or not, called inflationdata.com.
Jim McMahon?
Tim McMahon,
oh, okay.
His brother.
Gotcha. Not the Super Bowl shuffle.
No, his brother.
Okay.
So he mentioned this 2001 paper that concluded that unemployment causes 1.7 times more misery than inflation. And so if you're doing any kind of misery index that uses those two, you need to first multiply the unemployment number by 1.7 before adding it to the inflation number to properly weight it.
Yeah.
I'm like, how did they come up with that? So I looked at the paper, and it was actually pretty clever. There's like 23 years of this survey of life satisfaction and happiness that these researchers looked at back in 2001. And they found that...
economically based or just like how happy are you?
No, here's the thing. It was how happy are you? It was like a single question. Like, would you say, based on how you're feeling right now, that you are fairly satisfied, unsatisfied, very satisfied with your life right now, right? And then they took that measurement for that country as a whole. And you can do this for any country that participated in the survey. And then they looked at inflation, and then they looked at unemployment for mm-hmm. those years, and they could figure out the variation between, or the interplay between unemployment and inflation and satisfaction. And they found that that unemployment was 1.7 times more miserable than inflation in regards to life satisfaction.
Gotcha.
As that survey goes. It's pretty clever.
Yeah.
It's a lot of hocus pocus, but I thought it was pretty clever how they did it.
That makes sense to me, because to be without work, like if you have a job and things, inflation is happening, you still have your job.
Sure. And you're like, man, this sucks to pay this much more, but you could still conceivably pay for
it. Yeah. I'll cut back here or there.
Right.
If you're unemployed, then there's not a lot of hope.
Right.
Yeah. That number might be conservative. Even.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you.
Very interesting stuff, sir.
So that's it, man. That's the misery index.
Mm-hmm.
You got anything else?
No, but I'm looking forward to hearing from economists that.
Me too.
Like, in an unbiased way, try to explain things.
Me too.
If you send just, you know, these crazy political emails, and they're going to fall on deaf ears because everyone yells at each other that they're right. I just want to hear some real numbers.
Yeah. Do it, Chuck. If you want to know more about the misery index, you can type those words in the search bar at howstuffworks.com. And since I said search bar, just plain old search bar, it's time for listener mail.
I'm going to call this follow up on Vocal Fry once again.
Oh, yeah.
Regarding Vocal Fry, guys, you guys were offended because someone said Vocal Fry was repulsive. But there is another side to this, dudes. I suffer from a neurological disorder known as misophonia, which we totally should do a show on this.
I agree.
It's a condition where a person has extreme emotional response to commonly occurring sounds. And I remember hearing a lot of times just like people chewing noises or gum or whatever. Mm-hmm. He said, in my case, my trigger noise is the high-pitched S sound when some people speak. It feels like my brain is cringing, as if an allergic reaction is taking place. Cannot stress enough, this is not a mere annoyance. It's a legitimate mental disorder that can vary greatly in severity. I don't visibly freak out when I hear my trigger noise, but it really kills me inside. It gives me an instant headache, and which is why I will get away from the noise if at all possible. I believe in avoiding complaining in life and playing the victim, but this disorder really has made my life like a subtle hell. It's been especially toxic to my family relationships and my ability to learn in school. I felt compelled to email you guys because you definitely appreciate interesting medical conditions. I think it would be a great topic for a show someday. There's a documentary about it called Quiet Please. If you watch the trailer, you might be inspired to watch it to learn what the condition is.
Oh, yeah.
Huge thanks to everyone at Stuff You Should Know. You make the mundane parts of my life interesting and educational. I'm going to anonymize this.
Okay.
From Texas, because I didn't hear back from him.
From Tex.
Yeah, Tex. P.S., I was in disbelief when Chuck said he had not seen Billy Madison or Happy Gilmore.
That's a good P.S.
I believe it.
It's a good postscript.
And post P.P.S., right? Not P.S.S.
I think it's post postscript.
Yeah, but people often put P.S.S.
It doesn't mean anything.
Do you think Stuff You Should Know could ever become a television show? Well,
no,
Tex.
Never.
We actually did that.
We found out the hard way that it came.
Yeah, we did a TV show on the Science Channel. And it ran for one full season that played out over the course of several days.
Which we'll always have, Chuck. We'll always have that season of television we did once.
It lasted 9 or 10 days.
Yeah.
Let's just show them all at once.
Yeah.
Out of order. But you never know. We might get another shot at stardom. But we're not looking to.
No.
I like it in this room where no one's looking at us.
Yeah.
Jerry doesn't even look at us.
No, she's just there looking away in disgust.
That's right.
Good idea about the misophonia. I think we mentioned that before. Like, I really liked that Vocal Fry episode, and that was the one thing that I wish we would have mentioned, because it's a legitimate thing that it
Absolutely.
Does affect some people.
Yeah.
But yeah, look for a misophonia episode at some point in the future, Tex. If you want to get in touch with us, we're all over social media. We're on Twitter and Instagram at SYSK Podcast. We're on Facebook.com/StuffYouShouldKnow. You can send us an email to StuffPodcast@HowStuffWorks.com. And you can join us at our very own home on the web, StuffYouShouldKnow.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Are you thirsty? Well, Richard's rainwater is caught clean before it even hits the ground. Rain is naturally pure, so there's no need for harsh chemicals or additives. Richard's rainwater contains no chlorine, no forever chemicals, no microplastics, no nothing. Enjoy the smooth, clean taste of still rainwater or the cold pressured bubbles of sparkling rainwater. Just visit richardsrainwater.com to find a retailer near you. That's richardsrainwater.com. And for a coupon, text STUFF to 251-292-8887 and receive $2 off a 12-pack case of Richard's Rainwater.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.